This is Danny and Gallant on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Streaming nationwide on the 710 Sports app and 710sports.com.
Now here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
By the way, on the show.
We're not even 10 games into this season, and we see this Mariners team for the second time digging itself out of a significant hole, right? Like five runs or more, trailing 6-0, entering the final four innings of the game. And the Mariners, well, in the season opener against the Giants, it was a five-run deficit. They walked their way back to that one. This one, they had the trots, the home run trots. Paul, as they were galloping and gallivanting around the bases, a literal home run derby over the final four innings.
It was really impressive to see them dig their way out of a hole, and this time do it with their actual bats, not by just resting them on their shoulders, and also no help from some just really bad defense like we saw from the Giants. This was a really impressive comeback, and considering, Danny, I think where we went into this weekend feeling about the team.
Yeah.
How much a dark day,
right? Friday came in here. We're feeling like Paxton's got to have Tommy John. They just got beat on by the Twins. They only won 1 of 3 against the Chicago White Sox. And now you come in here, you're like, hey, you see those five home runs they've hit these past two games? They take 2 of 3 in Minnesota against a pretty good Twins team. By the way, they got a little feisty. Their skip got thrown out yesterday. Yeah, I'd like to see the spunk of this Mariners team as they head on to Baltimore.
I feel very melodramatic because on Friday I go into the weekend thinking, oh man, I don't know about this season. And now I'm like, yeah, let's go. What's going to happen the rest of this month? I feel like I'm going to need to gird myself for the future of this month.
Gird your loins?
Gird them. Yeah, I'm going to have to because these up and downs, I need to handle them a lot better. I don't know why I'm not handling them as well as I am, especially the downside of it. But yesterday, man, that was impressive. Down 6 runs and rallying back, and Kyle Seager with the day he had at the plate. Really impressive.
Maybe we should just follow this team like the Yankees and Red Sox follow their teams because 28 Major League Baseball teams subscribe to the idea that it's a marathon and not a sprint. And those two fan bases basically have each one as, is this a must-win game or not? Are they able to right the course of their season? Does the parade continue? Maybe that's the sort of the all of a sudden the Mariners on the brink. At the verge of losing a series to the Twins, the second straight series that they lost, and this team said, no, no more. We are going to start clobbering pitches out and over the plate, including the cobbler. We're going to chase the cobbler out of here. All of a sudden, Shoemaker, he's gone. He's yelling at the ump as well over a pitch that was missed. Taylor Trammell's following that up with we put together a fancy montage of the big bats that the Mariners broke out that beat the Twins yesterday.
You know, just kind of dead in the water, not doing a whole lot, down 6-0 against their very quality opponent. And our guys just keep grinding out. Obviously, Seager's had a huge day. Seager's carried us today, but the first home run getting us going.
It's a high drive right field, and that's going to leave the ballpark. Home run, Kyle Seager. It's his first of the season. Mariners on the board here in the sixth.
Trammell on top of that kind of gets you into the dugout.
Hit hard. Deep right field. Trammell taking a look. That is out of here. 3-run homer. Taylor Trammell and the Mariners making big noise here in the sixth.
The power's starting to come. We were a little slow to hit some home runs out of the gate, but now you're starting to see guys, you know, settle in and find the stroke a little bit. There were huge home runs today. We don't get back in that game unless we hit the ball over the fence, and we did it today.
Fly ball, right field, deep, deep, deep. Wow. Gone! There we go! Kyle Seager with a 3-run jack, and the Mariners have an 8-6 lead.
I would like to say Dave Sims is a great weather vane for exactly the significance of each of those home runs. Like, you could hear it in his voice, which is the first one was, okay, not going out without a fight. At least making it respectable. Don't have a donut hanging up there. No bagels on the final scoreline. Like, good for Kyle. He clobbers that. And then the Trammell one's like, ho, this just got interesting here. All of a sudden, he destroyed it. He hurt Shoemaker in his feelings, too. Because after that, the cobbler, he was all of a sudden hollering at the home plate official, home plate ump. He had something to say about that, and they went back. I still can't figure out, like, was he mad at himself? And apparently then he was screaming at the ump. I saw an outtake where he was screaming about a pitch in the Marmolejos at bat where he thought he should have struck out Marmolejos 1-2. And the pitch got called a ball. He's like, that pitch changed the whole inning.
That's why he was upset. That was a bizarre sequence.
I thought the pitch that changed the whole the splitter that you hung to Trammell that he launched to Jupiter. I thought that was the pitch that changed the whole inning, tough guy.
I like that you're calling him the cobbler. It took me a moment to get
the cobbler.
That. I was like, wait a second. What are you saying here? Oh, shoemaker. That makes perfect sense. I like it. Corny, but great.
I don't think it's totally accurate because I believe a cobbler repairs shoes, doesn't make them. I believe that the cobbler's generally in charge of shoe repair. But yeah, that's what I've always called shoemakers. He's the cobbler.
Okay,
the cobbler going up against the cobbler tonight, and he left with his feelings hurt. He took it right in the shorts.
What they're doing right now at the plate, I hope this is sustainable. Do you think it is the power all of a sudden that you've seen? And I would say in particular from Taylor Trammell, this had to have been a big weekend for him. It was funny watching him on Saturday trying not to smile as he went around the base pass, but he could not keep it in as he was going around third base. Then he gets it in a back-to-back game. That I'm curious about, if this is something that we can expect on a regular basis from Taylor Trammell, because we saw it back-to-back days, but it's about time, right? I mean, we thought this lineup would have a little more pop, and to this point they had not shown it. Then this weekend they changed that.
They did. Over the first seven games they hit two home runs, and that was not typical. That's not what you would expect from this team. Not with Seager, and they're going to have some pop from guys. I think it remains to be seen, like, how much of a power threat is someone like Dylan Moore. But I believe Ty France, I think Trammell is a guy that can hit you about 20 home runs if he gets a full season. I'm not sure if he's going to be more than that. It's a decent lineup. I don't think you're going to have the biggest boppers in the league, but Haniger, like, you've got some power. You should be an average power team. And hitting five home runs over these past two games kind of puts him back up. I think they'll still average seven home runs that they've hit over nine games. I think they'll be a little bit. I think they'll have more pop than that when it's all said and done. But we'll see. This was closer to what you'd expect. I don't know if they're going to be able to keep climbing out of these deficits. And they've won five games, and three of them they've trailed by three runs or more entering the second half of the game. They came back from a 5-1 run deficit against the Giants in the season opener. They came back from a 3-run deficit, and now they've come back from a 6-run deficit. And all that's happened in the latter half of the game. I want to give credit for their patience and that they weighed out the starting pitcher, but that's an awful lot. They've had three big hairy innings so far this year that have done an awful lot of damage, and that's not something that you're typically going to be able to summon on command like they have.
It really has been strange from that perspective. When it has come for them, it has come and it has been bountiful, but there have been very long droughts along the way. It's sort of like rain in Texas. It's either not happening, or when it comes down, you end up getting a flood.
Yeah, and I'll say I like the spunk they showed yesterday. Service got thrown out because he got heated because they warned the Mariners after a changeup hit Byron Buxton, and that was after Ty France got busted up and in twice in the same at bat and got hit in the second one in his left kind of triceps. And he glared out at the mound after that, may or may not have asked for or given a specific command to the pitcher or suggestion after having hit him. I liked seeing the spunk. And honestly, I think that tension's going to be a little bit residual when it comes to the Twins. I think there might be a few hard feelings coming out after that, especially judging. I mean, Shoemaker was yelling after he gave up a home run to Trammell. Trammell kind of watched that homer go, which I think he earned by how far he hit it. But yeah, I liked it. I liked the little saltiness. The spicy quotient went up.
It's a shame that they're not going to play against the Twins again until June, because yeah, I like actually having beef with other baseball teams. And to this point, doesn't really feel like the Mariners. You could point at one team and say, oh, we really hate those, other than the Astros, right? Because obviously cheaters. But you take a look at all these other teams. Is there really one that you look at that could be the rival? And of course, this would be cool with the Twins, but yeah, if you don't play him for 2 months, Danny, I think that's going to go away, don't you?
No.
They'll hold that grudge?
These are baseball players. Oh, of course. That's exactly how baseball works. Like, you've got a receipt. You owe them one. Like, and there's, I'll be interested to see, like, do the Twins feel that, because Buxton did get hit with the pitch in his back in a very suspicious spot. Now it was a changeup. Also, not going to put Byron Buxton on the bases in that close of a game. Like, that's the last thing you want, is that guy running around. But there's probably some hard feelings. I don't think Ty France was too thrilled about the way they pitched him that whole series for the most part, especially when it caps off with them busting him up and in and then hitting him after being dusted. Yeah, I think there's some hard feelings. Baseball players thrive in holding those sort of things. Plus, you got Service was sick of this umpire crew. It was great. He was just sick of it. You guys are terrible. Give us a warning after a changeup.
9 games in a row with the same umpire crew. And not only that's a lot. They traveled to Minnesota with you. I mean, that would be obnoxious. I would, that part of it in particular, like, if it's, I understand that you don't want the umpires traveling around and you have the first 6 games the same umpire crew. But yeah, they follow you. Yeah, I can understand why Scott Service got a little teed off.
I think they finally ditch him now. I think they get a new, I think those dudes stay in Minnesota, and I think Seattle will get a fresh group. So no more Laz Diaz for a little bit. It's Danny and Gallant. It's time for Front Page News.
This is the Front Page. Today's top 2 stories and why they matter. Every morning at 7:10. Get what you need to know to start your day right now.
All right. If you've been... sounds like Alex Rodriguez, and he's got a partner. I'd never heard the guy's name before, Mark Lohr, who is an e-commerce guy, I guess, are going to buy the Timberwolves. Like, they're getting close. They're going to buy the Timberwolves from Glenn Taylor, who is the Target owner. $1.5 billion. Go ahead, Paul, but I'm going to warn you. I don't want to hear it.
They're coming home. They're coming home. Stolen from Minnesota. They're coming home. Bring them back. Bring back the Sonics. This is the first step. No one cares about basketball in Minnesota. That team has not been good. They have not lived up to whatever expectations there may have been at one point a long time ago when Kevin Garnett was wearing that uniform. Take them. Take them, A-Rod. Redeem yourself. Come back.
I have no desire to be part of any of the flirtation or ongoing negotiation that might go on with the potential relocation. I'm not going to say that if the Timberwolves ended up relocating that I would be against it, but I don't even want to discuss it until they've broken up with Minnesota. Until they've dumped, until there is an actual, they have to actually be separated. The divorce doesn't have to be final, but they have to have made it clear that they're moving on. Otherwise, you're the old skeevy dude hitting on married and committed relationships at the bar. Don't be that guy.
But this is a relationship that just isn't
don't
working
be that
out.
Guy.
It's a relationship that's just
no,
work, not working
No, you don't know
out.
That. You don't know that. You don't know that. Don't mess with another man's rhubarb.
I love how you had that say.
Yeah. Never rub another man's rhubarb. I
will rub the rhubarb away. I'm sorry. You need to get this basketball team back. This is how you do it. You got to get dirty. You got to roll up your sleeves and dive headfirst into the poo.
It's not rolling up your sleeves. It's drowning yourself in Dracar Noir or whatever sort of cheesy cologne you might have. Yeah, isn't that what all the cheesy dudes wore when I was in high school?
You guys
wore Cool Water.
My mom got me like Tommy Hilfiger cologne, and I was wearing it. Honestly, it lasted like 15 years. I actually have to get new cologne now. Fun fact, everybody. Next up.
The Front Page.
An event unlike any other. Hey, Hideki Matsuyama, have a weekend. He hangs on to win the Masters despite a late surge from Xander Schauffele, who came on strong at the end before an unfortunate triple bogey on the 16th hole. Also, Will Zalatoris looks like the caddy in Happy Gilmore. He came in second. I feel bad more for Xander Schauffele than I'm happy for Hideki Matsuyama, because imagine you have a late surge and then at 16 you go triple bogey. There was something about it, and you just saw it when the ball went into the water, and you just saw it in his face, and all of a sudden you realize that, yeah, we aren't going to have a down-to-the-wire Masters finish. That was a big bummer. I felt for him, man. I don't think I would want to get that close only to lose all of a sudden at the very end because I screwed up.
No, man. You want to get as close as possible. Like, come on. You don't want to have the thrill of maybe winning because it might stink to lose. That's the most millennial thing in the world. It's better to never try.
That's not what I'm suggesting. It's more, it's on the 16th hole. You're that close, and then you lose by blowing it. And now aren't people going to look at you as somebody who choked in that spot, even though you were having a really good day up to that point? Like, if he just came in second place without that triple bogey, you're having an entirely different conversation about this. He got that close, and then he blew it on that one shot.
You would rather be a non-factor and not remembered then put yourself in a position where people might think you blew it. What a terrible lesson
in golf
that you're preaching.
In just golf, in general. Yes. In golf, yes.
That sounds like somebody who decided he didn't want to field punts when he was put in there as the backup punt returner because he didn't want
to this.
Risk messing it up.
Well, smart move.
There's a common thread that I'm pointing out here. There's a common thread here.
I hate you. It's smart move, though.
It's the front page. Let's bring in the professor, John Clayton. It's time for the morning drive.
John Clayton's Morning Drive with Danny and Gallant.
It's a four-way battle, and there's only going to be three spots. Somebody has to go.
The first and final word on everything NFL from the professor, John Clayton.
They scored 30 points a game. They're the best running team in football.
It's John Clayton's Morning Drive with Danny and Gallant.
Professor, we saw an interesting piece over the weekend about Aaron Rodgers, where an anonymous agent is basically saying that I guess the Green Bay Packers are waiting to do anything until something is done about Aaron Rodgers' contract. What's your read into that situation in Green Bay and I guess the future of it? If maybe there is something to come, maybe not this year, but next year.
Well, I mean, I think what it comes down to is that, they've had to redo six contracts so far just to get under the cap. They've not signed anybody in unrestricted free agency or street free agents. I mean, yeah, they picked up, some guys at, minimum salary that were less than $920,000 in that. But it comes down to that, Aaron wants some certainty as far as how long he can stay there. And so he's not going to do any kind of a restructure and, give them cap room unless they make a commitment that he can stay more than another year. And so they don't want to take this on a year-to-year basis. So it does show you there's a lot of tension between both sides. You also have the fact that for the second straight year, they didn't get him a receiver. They didn't get him a tight end. Yeah, they were able to get Mercedes Lewis back, but he's 85 years old. And so it's like, it basically said, this is probably the last year this team is going to be, a top contender because, they've added nothing. And right now they can't get anything done with Rodgers. And, I think the simple thing would be trade Jordan Love. Give Aaron Rodgers a certainty. I mean, he won 13 games in each of the last two seasons.
That's an interesting thought that I had not considered. But what would Love fetch? Would he fetch more? It seems like everybody's quarterback nuts right now.
Yeah.
Like all the teams, and especially at the top of the draft, would Love fetch a top 10 pick right now, you think, if they decided to trade him?
Well, let's put it this way. The Packers got him by trading up into the bottom of the first round, so you're not going to get a top 10 pick. You're probably just going to get a fourth-round pick, maybe a fifth-round pick, something like that. Maybe you'll get something for next year, but you're not going to get the value to what you drafted him. But, of course, you have already on your team a Hall of Fame quarterback who wants to complete his career in Green Bay. And right now, the uncertainty, and of course, they're paralyzed until they can resolve this situation because, again, they haven't added anything. I mean, this team right now has offensive line issues. Sure, they can use the draft to do some things, but you can just see how bad that Love acquisition was last year and the damage it's doing and the tension right there that's with Aaron Rodgers.
The thing that's been tough for me to figure out with this is initially I thought it was the Packers that were holding off on renegotiating this contract, that Rodgers would want it renegotiated because if you defer salary cap costs down the road, which is what a renegotiation would do, it would make the team less likely to cut him. It would make it harder for them to do that because they'd have to eat more cap space. That story, though, where there's an agent saying that the Packers have told him, hey, if you hang out for a little bit here, wink, wink, we think we're going to have more room open up, made me think that, well, Rodgers actually has some stipulations on what will be done for him to sign off on a renegotiation. So he might not be
all that eager to do exactly what the team wants unless he gets something that he feels is advantageous out of it.
Yeah, that's what he wants. It's not like he's trying to – I don't think he's angling for a raise or anything of that nature. But, you know, he'd like to find some kind of a, you know, three-year commitment or something of that nature to know he's going to be there for some period of time. And if not, then it's just you kind of hold off on him. I mean, they've already had to pay him a reporting bonus, a roster bonus that he had due. That's already in his bank. It's already checked out. But now it's a matter that, you know, if it's just going to be a year-to-year thing where they restructure and all that stuff, I mean, certainly the situation's not as bad cap-wise as it is with Matt Ryan, because they made a commitment with the restructure with Matt Ryan's contract that he has $108 million of proration over the remainder of his contract. So that means that's why they're not going to take a quarterback at four, because, you know, there's no way in the next 2 years they could trade him, cut him, do whatever. So it's like, but, you know, you're right about that, because if Aaron does get a restructured contract, it is going to be harder with the cap next year and the year after that to be able to move him. And so, yeah, it's a stalemate.
John, I think we're all in agreement that it's going to be a while before we actually see Jadeveon Clowney sign a deal. He's supposedly meeting with Cleveland today. Where do you think he will end up, though?
I think he's going to end up in Cleveland, because this is his second visit. I mean, he was interested enough to go once, and now he's coming back. And so I think something's going to get done. Now, the curious part is, what's going to be the price? Because you look at all things in the NFL right now, most things are at the minimum. Now, he's not going to be able to command even probably the $13 million that he got last year from Tennessee. But the Browns have cap room. They've had a great offseason. You know, they can put him on the other side of Myles Garrett. So it does sound like there's some interest. But now the price, is it going to be right?
John, who do you think the favorite is in the AFC North? It's a really good division. Mm-hmm. It usually is. The Ravens didn't do all that much in free agency. I mean, they got Kevin Zeitler, which helps them. The Steelers, you have the question of Ben Roethlisberger and what he's going to be like when he comes back. Who would you list as the favorite in that division?
You know, on paper right now, you'd have to say it's Cleveland, believe it or not. And the reason you say that is
that... you believe you're saying that?
I know.
Can you believe you're saying that, John?
Yeah, because
you
I
just said Cleveland.
I just did, because, again, you're talking about a team, they made the playoffs last year. They've been able to add different things. They may be able to get Jadeveon Clowney. And, you know, Baker Mayfield really played well toward the end of the season. And so, but you look at Baltimore, and what's still up in the air is that they lost their best two pass rushers. They lose two edge rushers, including Matthew Judon. And so that's not good. Then you come back and you look at Pittsburgh, and their offensive line's an absolute mess. Marquise Pouncey retired. They haven't done anything at the left tackle position. Alejandro Villanueva is still unsigned. They have an opening at guard because they lose Matt Feeler. And so that's why you take a look, they lose Bud Dupree on linebacker and Vince Williams. And so they're still good. They still have Ben Roethlisberger. They were able to get Juju Smith-Schuster back. But right now, I think you'd have to almost on paper. And again, this is before the draft. And so that could change during a draft. But on paper right now, you have to say Cleveland.
It is weird to see that the AFC now, it's the Browns that are at the top. It's the Bills that are close to the top as well in that conference. Okay, John, so we'll see if Jadeveon Clowney ends up in Cleveland. Do you feel that in Houston right now, the situation that we are seeing, that there is any, I guess, chance of a resolution that the NFL is going to make anytime soon? I'm surprised that they have been sitting back on the sidelines as long as they have.
There's no reason for him to do anything now. I mean, you got a situation. If they do something now, is it going to change the equation that, you know, the cases are still going to be in court and he doesn't want to be in Houston? It's not like he's going to go to an OTA. It's not like he's going to go to mini camp. It's not like he's going to go to training camp. I mean, he doesn't want to be there. And so it's like, why make a rash judgment? First, let's see if the police are going to do anything. And then once the police decide they're either going to put a case together or not put a case together, then you make a decision. I mean, why put somebody on the exempt list when you know he's not going to be on the field or with the team till probably the end of summer?
Professor, we always appreciate your time. We always learn something from it. We'll look forward to talking to you tomorrow. Thanks so much.
Okay, thanks.
That is John Clayton. You can hear him this afternoon with Wyman and Bob. And yeah, the latest update that I'd seen in the Deshaun Watson case was that his attorney, Rusty Hardin, had said that some consensual activity, sexual activity, did occur between Deshaun Watson and
some of the massages, right?
The massage therapists that were there, which honestly,
made me ask more questions about what exactly was going on, because the previous explanation had seemed to be that, hey, these were professional engagements that had happened, and he had 18 massage therapists who had worked with him that said that nothing inappropriate occurred. So I'm like, well, what exactly? I was puzzled by that. Like, if the defense is going to be, hey, stuff happened, but it was consensual, that makes it, in some ways, that erases some of my questions about what exactly was going on, that he was like, there was sexual impropriety going on. Like, right? If he's hiring massages and then expecting sexual contact to come out of that, we'll see what happens there. But I tend to side with you, Paul. I'm not sure how long the NFL is going to want to just let this play out as he remains without placing him on some sort of exempt list.
At the very least, it looks really bad right now, and it's hard. I mean, it's hard to right now find, I think, the benefit of the doubt here. And I understand there is the idea of, you know, innocent until proven guilty, all of that. But this is a civil matter, and right now, I mean, there's so much against him, and it's just hard to imagine that there's not going to be some resolution that doesn't result in punishment. I feel like the NFL, traditionally, they get ahead of the curve when it comes to that. Right now, it feels like they're trying to just bury their head in the sand and maybe hope this story goes away. It's not.
The Mariner bats came to life. 5 home runs over the past 2 games. That was after 3 home runs. I shortchanged them. I said they had 2 over the first 7 games of the season. It was 3 over the first 7 games. Mariners now at 8 home runs. That doesn't mean they're done with the lumber, though. We'll explain next.
You're listening to Danny and Gallant,
powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios
on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
Pineda will face Mitch Haniger here. Pitch. Swung on and slugged to left field. This is hammered. This has got a chance. It's going to go out of here. Upper deck. Mitch Haniger into the second level. Turns on it for the second home run of the inning. Just blasts it to left field, and the Mariners have a 2-0 lead for Mitch, his second long ball of the season.
It was nice to see the Mariners' bats finally wake up this weekend. Power! They were able to knock it out of the park 5 times. And, you know, Danny, when you look at the lineup right now, you have in Mitch Haniger, who you just heard hit the home run, in Ty France, and in Kyle Seager. I think 3 guys who you look at and you think, okay, maybe this is something, what they're doing right now is sustainable for the remainder of the year. And then you have Taylor Trammell hitting home runs as well. My question is, at what point does this potentially make us believe that they can do this for the entirety of a year, where it's not just these 3 guys? And also, are they going to be able to keep this power up? I mean, it was great to finally see it, but is this the anomaly, what we've seen these last 2 games, or is the first 7 games of the year where they were not able to really drive any power, is that the anomaly?
Well, they're middle of the pack right now. They've hit 8 home runs. That's fairly middle of the pack across the league. I don't know if this is going to be an above-average slugging team. I do believe they're going to get better as the year goes along. I believe one of the assets this team has is that it is going to be fairly patient. It is going to work walks, and they are going to get deeper into bullpens. Through 9 games, I think I'm fairly confident in saying that we'll see that. And they should get better as the year goes along. But one of the things you have about a team, it's a young, aggressive lineup. And when they get on the bases, I think you'll see a little bit of the sort of the contagious big innings that we've had. It's a young group, and I think energy can make up for a lot. I don't know if they're going to be above average or below average when it comes to their overall power numbers, but I think they're going to be kind of in that middle third. I don't think they're going to be in the top third, and I don't think they're going to be in the bottom third.
Middle third's not a bad spot to be, and we're all curious.
Right. That's kind of the bucket that they're in.
Right, and look, you hope that is going to allow you to just score enough, and with the Mariners pitching, I think they are going to need to probably be closer to that top third if they do want to potentially contend this year, but I don't think any of us are really expecting that. I am feeling a lot better about the team after this weekend. We're hoping that there's going to be some reinforcements at some point this year, and specifically it's Jared Kelnick. Jerry DePoto was on SiriusXM Radio this weekend with Jim Bowden, and he was talking about their process, not just the process at the plate, their process as they go through and trying to get these younger players ready to go and potentially make major league debuts. And he talked about how Jared Kelnick, Julio Rodriguez, and Cal Raleigh, they're playing in this co-op league in Arizona.
And in the meantime, you've got Jared Kelnick and Julio Rodriguez, who both had excellent springs and really couldn't have done more to open eyes. They're playing down in Arizona in a organized co-op league that we've got working down there that's very similar to the Arizona Fall League. We've got the better prospects from multiple teams in the West Valley of Phoenix playing games, and Jared and Julio, among others, Cal Raleigh, some of our best young pitchers, are getting regular reps in that space between when the major league camp ended and the minor league camp begins.
I'm really curious, Danny, about how that league could affect the way that Jerry DePoto looks at this process. Does he need to see Jared Kelnick at the AAA level, or is some successful play potentially at this level going to be maybe enough for Jerry to say, you know, it looks like he's ready, time to bring him aboard?
I don't think we're going to see him in the next month or two. Like, I don't expect to see Kelnick before June. And maybe I'm wrong about that. If there's the possibility that, hey, and that he just needed a little bit more time, then yeah, I suppose it could. I think we're going to need to see him. I think he's going to be at AAA for a month. And here's the flip side of that as well. If you're looking for an offensive boost, I don't think you're looking for it or should expect it from any of those young guys, right? Because they're going to be learning on the job when they get to the big league level. I don't expect Kelnick to be an above average hitter. I honestly don't expect him to be an average MLB hitter. He's probably going to scuffle for his first year. And that, by the way, is totally okay because he's going to have to do that learning. Like that's just going to have to happen. And he'll get that out of the way, and his ceiling's so high, it doesn't really matter. But I don't believe that Cal Raleigh or Kelnick or Julio Rodriguez or any of those kind of prospects are the kind of person you're going to turn to hope for them to add something to your lineup.
Well, if they're better, though, than like a Sam Haggerty or a Braden Bishop.
But I don't know that they're going to be better. I think long term they will be. And you can make an argument that, hey, get him up here. And look, Ryan Davis pointed this out on Twitter, and it's a strong argument. He thinks that Kelnick should have been up here from the beginning. And the reason is because he's not going to be challenged in the same way, even in AAA, that he would be at the big league level. And you're eventually going to have to learn. And if he does the learning at the big league level, what's the difference between that and doing it in a co-op league down there? But I don't think anybody expects that he's going to hit above 220 in his 21-year-old season in the major leagues.
Still, though, I feel like that would be better than what you're getting out of Haggerty and out of Bishop right now. And there is the whole, hey, Kyle Lewis hasn't played yet, and once Kyle Lewis starts playing, maybe this conversation goes to the side. Jerry DePoto had a talk with Jared Kelnick, and he told that to Jim Bowden on SiriusXM.
I had a very lengthy talk with Jared, and we talked through the things that we would like to see him accomplish. In addition to getting experience at the upper levels in general, we were specifically detailing, you know, an approach against left-hand pitching. And by no fault of his own, he just hasn't had an opportunity to see the lefties at the top of the league, you know, at AA, AAA, major league level lefty. And, you know, that's something he's going to have to adjust to. We don't think it's going to be an issue that gets in his way. We're trying to accelerate that development with some of what we're doing in April down in Arizona, be it in these co-op games or with our minor league games.
When I hear that, Danny, I see it, and I see Jerry's process playing out in the way that you see it playing out, where he's probably not going to be here for a month or two. Because when are you going to be going up against these lefties? Is it going to be in this league? How often are you going to be going up against them, as he laid it out? And it does seem like something that would have to take place over a couple of weeks, a couple of months.
I believe that they're waiting and thinking he's going to be. And it's in that regard, it's not about service time manipulation. It's about development.
Yeah.
And you can go all sorts of different ways on it. I think that what the Mariners believe is that we would rather have him more of a finished product when he gets to the big leagues, because we don't want to have the possibility of sending him back down. If he came up right away, if he was up right now and he was playing more because of the injury to Kyle Lewis and the injury to the injury to Fraley, you have the possibility that his approach, especially against left-handers, would be exposed to the point that you had to sit him some. That's happened. Mike Trout, when he first came up as an injury replacement, guess what happened after that? He went back down. the Mariners don't want to do that with Kelnick, and I guess that's what I'm saying about what you would expect once he gets here. I do not expect an above average and maybe not even average MLB outfield production from him at the plate. That doesn't mean it's not right to bring him up or he should wait, but I don't think that you're going to, if turning to him to provide an offensive boost, I think we're going to end up being disappointed about that.
He's Danny O'Neill. I'm Paul Gallant. It's Danny and Gallant, 710 ESPN Seattle. Up next, a prominent NFL talking head thinks there's a chance the Seahawks might take a quarterback in the first two rounds of the draft. I know. You got to hear this audio.
You are listening to Danny and Gallant on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
Probably one of my favorite top 10 hip-hop songs of all time. Absolutely love it. This or That is absolutely fantastic. The Choice is Yours by the Black Sheep. And this is going to be the start of a new segment that we do in which you get two options and you have to choose one of them. You're going to have to choose one of them. That is the rub. And in this case, you're going to have to choose which of the following opinions you would prefer to defend. You're basically going to be a public defender in which you are asked to defend one of the following two opinions. First of all, we have Jeremy Schapp, who, well, let's have him explain himself, his thoughts on drafting a quarterback among the top three picks.
I mean, seriously, is Zach Wilson really better than Sam Darnold? Who knows? Maybe he's the next Johnny Unitas. Maybe he's the next Geno Smith. In 2017, the Bears traded four picks to move up one spot to draft Mitchell Trubisky at second overall. They could have kept all those picks and taken Patrick Mahomes with room to spare. He went 10th. With the exception of the rare, very rare, almost impossibly rare sure thing, a la John Elway or Peyton Manning, you're probably better off using that top pick on an offensive lineman or linebacker. Late in the first round, after all, you can get an Aaron Rodgers. Or in the second, a Drew Brees. Or if you wait all the way until the sixth, Tom Brady. In the last 50 NFL drafts, 44 quarterbacks have been selected first, second, or third overall. And exactly two have gone on to win Super Bowls as the starters for the teams that drafted them. Troy Aikman and Peyton Manning.
You can draft a quarterback in the sixth round? That's a bold strategy. If you do
it works out pretty well.
It's
happened once. It's happened once where you've gotten a franchise, the one of the all-time best in the sixth round. Now, Jeremy Schapp, it sounds reasonable, right? He's got some facts there that there have been two quarterbacks taken in the top three in the past 50 years. Here's what's convenient about that. 51 years ago, Terry Bradshaw was drafted number one overall. He won four Super Bowls with the team that he drafted. Also not included in that list, John Elway, because while he only ever played for the Denver Broncos, was actually drafted by the Colts, right? Like the Colts were the team that traded him. Similarly for Eli Manning. So there is a little bit of semantics going on here of it's not quite as futile as Jeremy's argument would lead you to believe. That's the first argument. You can choose to defend that one. The second one is Dan Orlovsky. The other Danny O, as I like to think of him as. His tweet. Three teams that I could see, quote unquote, shocking us and drafting a QB in round one, early round two, like Green Bay did last year? Minnesota, Seattle, New Orleans. What pick do you suppose they're going to use to take that quarterback in the first round or early second, Dan? Not seeing that draft pick on the board.
I have to pick one of these.
You have to choose, and you can choose that out there too. 710-710, you can text it in. Which would you be better able to defend? Which piece of talking head inanity would you be better equipped? Would you prefer to try? Which hill do you want to die on?
I mean, the easier one to defend, I think, is with Jeremy Schapp, because the idea of not going all in to draft a quarterback early on, if you trust your draft process, you should be able to build a roster around the team. I think that's where he is going with that argument. But at the same time, yeah, if you're in a bad spot, the best place to get a best quarterback prospect is by trading up. I actually think the Orlovsky one is defendable from this perspective. He's looking for things that could be shocking that take place round one or in the second round. if the Seahawks have that spot, if they're still at 56 and a quarterback falls down, would it be crazy if the Seahawks decided to take a quarterback in that spot?
Yes, it would. Yes, it
would you
be
insane? Would you be surprised, like completely
yes.
surprised if it happened?
I would be completely surprised. I would be completely surprised that Seattle strikes the match that formally lights the relationship with their franchise quarterback aflame over a quarterback they chose 56th overall. Yes, yes. If they did that, I would say, because it's not just a quarterback at 56th overall. It's not just a second round pick. It's the quarterback you're picking after. I mean, if they do that, they're announcing that we're moving on from Russell Wilson, right? Like, that would actually be an escalation of the beef. And in some ways, it would be the biggest shot that's been fired in any sort of friction with the quarterback. You don't ruin a relationship with a franchise quarterback over the 56th pick in the draft.
Is the relationship that great as it is? That is, I think, debatable.
Dude, you do not set this on fire at this point. I don't care how bad you think it is. You don't make it worse.
I'm not disagreeing that it would be setting it on fire. I'm not disagreeing with that idea. But my question about that pick, should it be considered setting it on fire? If you're a quarterback yes. and someone drafts a quarterback in the second round, like we saw all those years ago with Jimmy Garoppolo and Tom Brady, or like we saw with Jordan Love, if a guy falls to the back of the first round, isn't it in that franchise's best interest to take that guy should he fall? Like with Aaron Rodgers. Aaron Rodgers fell to the back of the first round. The Packers had Brett Favre.
But they were already looking at, I don't know how far of it, already flirted with retirement. Like there had been at this point, that would be like you, if you were in a committed relationship, I'm not even going to say full fledged marriage, that would be like starting a Tinder profile.
Oh,
that would be like starting a Tinder profile. And would you like, I'm not breaking up yet. I'm just seeing what's out there. I'm not going to go out on any other dates. I'm just going to see what might happen. If you draft a – and if – here's the other thing. You've had 9 years to draft another quarterback in that position. They've taken one quarterback in that time, and it was in the seventh round for a guy named Magoo. Like that, you can't sit there, oh, this is just how we do it. We just draft another quarterback. We take the best player. No, you don't. No, you haven't. If you take that, that is setting up a Tinder profile and exploring your options, whether or not you're admitting it or not.
I like the reference. It's very accurate. Here's what I look at, though, and it's a what could have happened scenario. Clearly, a couple of years ago, the Seahawks were at the very least interested enough in Josh Allen to go view him at a pro day.
Uh-huh. Yep.
If Josh Allen had fallen to the back of the first round, which I honestly thought was a lot more possible than it obviously wasn't. It didn't happen that way. But I thought it actually was possible going into the draft because it felt like everyone was, wow, he's got all this talent, but is he going to be able to put it together? If he had been available for the Seahawks to take, do you think the Seahawks would have taken him?
No, I don't. They maybe would have. I think they've always kind of talked a big game about evaluating at any position. And I think it's weird that Russell's gotten that bent out of shape, or Russell's agent has gotten that bent out of shape over that.
I agree.
There's two constant points is that they attended the pro days of Mahomes and Allen. And that's always been trotted out as, hey, they don't really love Russ. I think that's an overreaction, but I also think that the Seahawks were putting on they made a point of that. I think that was a purpose pitch. I don't have much doubt because I don't think they would have. One of the things I know is they liked Bryce Petty. You remember the quarterback was he had a TCU?
Baylor. Yeah.
Baylor, who ended up going in the fourth round to the Jets. They had talked, and I had heard people, like there were people in the building that kind of liked him and thought maybe he was like a second round pick. They didn't touch him the second or third round. No, I don't think they would have taken another quarterback. And if they take another quarterback now, that would say everything to me. Don't go setting up a Tinder profile. Don't go doing that now. Like at this point, what's the upside would be is like, okay, we're going to take whatever percentage chance there is of salvaging this and keeping it long term together for the next 9 years. Over the 56th pick in the draft. Like, that's a terrible risk-reward evaluation.
But he shouldn't get that upset if it's the 56th overall pick, right? I mean, it's the 56th overall
matter.
Pick.
Dude, you know how he's going to react.
I know.
He's going to be the person that, why are you on Tinder? I'm just seeing. Just seeing how you
I'm trying to make friends.
It's Danny and Gallant. We're going to get to the other side of this and why it's tough to defend Jeremy Schapp's position. That's next.